Parshat Shelach is devoted, certainly the first half, first two-thirds, one may say, to the matter of the Meraglim. And as we know, of the 12 that were sent to spy out the land, one of them went with a new name, and that's Yehoshua. And this is discussed in Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Tet Zayin. The Torah has told us the names of all of those that went to look at the land. Eile Shemos HaNoshim Asher Shalach Moshe L'Suras HaAretz Vayikro Moshe L'Hoshea Ben Nun Yehoshua. Moshe called Hoshea Yehoshua. There is a shaila amongst the Mefarshim Rishonim speak about it. When exactly did he change Hoshea's name to Yehoshua? It seems that the change occurred now. However, we actually reference to Yehoshua earlier on in the Chumash. The first time we meet him is in Parshas Beshalach. As soon as we left Mitzrayim, Vayavo Amalek, and Mayomer Moshe El Yehoshua, Bechalon Anoshim. He's already referred to as Yehoshua from that early time. Some suggest that although the change occurs now, but since that became his name, he's referred to even earlier on as Yehoshua. That's what the Maharsha says in Maseches Sota. And others say almost the opposite, in the sense that the change took place earlier on, but it was primarily with reference to this episode that it was done so. And therefore he was already known as Yehoshua, but it was for this. Even though that was yet in the future. So something is happening with an eye on the future. Either the Torah is calling him Yehoshua with an eye on the future, even though it wasn't yet his name, or Moshe changed his name at that stage with an eye on the future. Be that as it may, his name became Yehoshua, and of course everyone wants to know what's behind this changing of the name from Hoshea to Yehoshua. Rashi quotes the words of the Gemara in Maseches Sota, Lamed Daled Amud Beis, it's a well-known Rashi, that this name change was accompanied or represented a tefillah for the success and safety of Yehoshua. Hispalel Alav, says Rashi, he davened for him, Ka Yoshiacha Me'atzas Meraglim. May Hashem save you from the counsel of the Meraglim. Now, the simple reading of these words and their well-known words seems to imply that Moshe already knew that the other Meraglim were not up to par. I mean, they represented a danger, so much so that he's davening for Yehoshua that he shouldn't be influenced by them. Moshe has already identified that seemingly all the other Meraglim, as far as we can tell from this tefillah, are no good. And Yehoshua needs to be saved from them. Which raises the question, why does he send those men then, if there's already considered something wrong with them? I'm not sure what the alternatives are. Anyone who would go from those tribes would be equally suspect. And moreover, the question beckons, if Moshe's davening, the people shouldn't fall into bad ways, so instead of davening for Yehoshua, who's the safest among them all, he should daven for all the others, that they shouldn't be Meraglim, they shouldn't be them, and have those ideas, if it's possible to do such a thing. So, of all the people to choose to daven for, given that they are the ones with the problem, and Moshe seems to be davening for the one without the problem, so what are we to make of this? I came across a very interesting insight in the writings of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zatzal, in his comments on Rashi, and although it's quite a striking new reading of what Rashi is saying, from a certain point of view, it's actually a more accurate reading, as we will see. So the background is really to understand what these men are going for. What's their job? What are they looking to find out? Well, the verb that is used in the beginning of the Parsha, and really for all of Shelach, is latur, v'yosuru es eretz kana'an, v'yishlach Hashem Moshe, asher shalach Moshe lasur es ha'aretz. And what is latur es ha'aretz? Naturas Haaretz seemingly means to evaluate the land. And in fact, Moshe breaks their mission down into small pieces, where he says, Ureisim es Haaretz Mahi, see the land, is it Hatovahi Imra'a, Hashmeinahi Imraza, what about the people, Chazaku Harafer, what about the city? It's all about evaluating strengths and weaknesses, and so on and so forth. That's called Latur, as Moshe describes it in detail. What's important to realize is that the Jewish people had already come to Moshe with ideas of sending people, that we find out in Parshas Devarim, but not only had they preempted with this idea, it wasn't actually completely the same idea. Because as the Pasuk describes in Devarim there, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Kaf Aleph, Atikruvun Alei Kulchem, you came to me and you said, Nishlecha Anashim Lefaneinu, let's send people, Ve'yachburu Lanu Es Ha'aretz, and they should begin to analyze and literally dig up the land, meaning to find out what? Es Haderech Nelech Ba, how should we enter, what's the best way to enter Eretz Yisrael. That's quite a different mission. Moshe's mission is about evaluation. Their mission is about strategy, almost, forming some form of a plan of attack, plan of entry. And therefore, not only do we see that Moshe, in a sense, is responding to their request in the beginning of Shelach, he's actually looking to depart from their request, whereas what they would like to do is act as meraglim. Meraglim, how shall we enter? How shall we attack? How can we catch them unawares? What's the weakest point? And so on and so forth. Whereas Moshe actually is looking to move them away from that into really other questions about just generally the quality of the land, the quality of the people, etc. And the question is, why? Why is that the more valuable or more meaningful thing to find out? Well, the Rebbe says there is a problem with going in as meraglim. Because the very nature of meraglim is that it involves an element of deception, of somehow misrepresentation. You're looking to find weaknesses, and it's altogether a rather more devious enterprise than gathering information in terms of evaluating the quality of something, strong or weak, good or bad. And whereas on the one hand, it might seem more helpful, because you want to know how to attack, there's something potentially dangerous about looking at things that way. Namely, as soon as a person or a group of people assume a devious way of doing things, then it's often difficult to know where that deception will end. As soon as you embark on that way of doing things, you do not inform people of everything that's really true, and you keep your real motives hidden, and you're looking to exploit, and that whole way that a meragel looks, given the condition of the Jewish people at this stage, that's not a healthy way for this group of people to begin to look at things. Because if they begin acting that way toward the people of Canaan, it may then filter into the way that they relate to Bnei Yisrael and Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's an altogether unhealthy approach. And not necessary here. And therefore, Moshe looks to change it to dry facts and a quality evaluation as opposed to way of deception. And the Rebbe says, this now is what Moshe means when he davens for Yeshua, Kol Yoshiacha Me'atzas Meraglim. We have understood that the word Meraglim here refers to a group of people, the Meraglim, namely the other 10 who could be a bad influence on Yehoshua. But it's interesting to note that if they are the known entity known as the Meraglim, so then perhaps it should have said Kol Yoshiacha Me'atzas HaMeraglim, because they're the Meraglim, they're people, they're a known entity. It doesn't say Me'atzas HaMeraglim. It says Me'atzas Meraglim. And the Rebbe explains that Moshe hasn't yet identified, and perhaps, indeed, Rashi tells us, Osa Shah Kesherim Hayu. At that time they were Kesherim. Moshe doesn't look upon them as being possible. And he's not talking about them as the bad group. Hashem should save you from the Eitzah of that bad group. But rather, Hashem should save you from an entire way of looking at things which is known as Atzas Meraglim, the Council of Meraglim, the approach of Meraglim. And even before anything's gone wrong, and no one's done anything wrong, Moshe is saying to Yeshua, see to it that you stick to the mandate of Latur Es Haaretz and don't drift into a mode which is known as Atzas Meraglim. And with this in mind, perhaps, although it's ironic because everybody else turned into Meraglim except for Yehoshua and Kalev, but at this stage perhaps the reason why Yehoshua is the one that needed the bracha is because from a certain point of view, Yehoshua would be most inclined to move into Atzas Meraglim for the simple reason that it is known already that Yehoshua will be the one that will lead Bnei Yisrael into Eretz Canaan. Which means that for 11 of the 12 people that are going there, should you ask them what's the best way to attack, it's kind of not their problem, in the sense that it's not their decision. It's easier for them, therefore, just to stick to what they've been told to do. Is it a good land, fertile, etc., strong people, weak people, the cities, etc.? Yehoshua will have strategy on his mind, because he's looking at the land that he needs to conquer. They know from Eldad Umedad, as we saw in the end of Parshas Balosecha, Moshe, Meis, Yehoshua Mechnis on the Aretz, and therefore, the irony is that Moshe reasons, perhaps, that of all those that would be inclined to take the Meraglim way of looking at things, it's Yehoshua. If Yehoshua stays on board, everyone will stay on board. As it turned out, everybody else went overboard, and Yehoshua, with Kalev, was the only one that stayed. But this I thought to be a very interesting way of looking at the well-known Rashi, Koyoshiacha Mi'atzas Meraglim, not the Eitzah of that group called Meraglim, but a kind of way of looking at things which is known as Atzas Meraglim, even before anything has gone wrong. So those are the comments of the Rebbe there on that Rashi. Now, we know that things worked out very badly with the Meraglim. They came back, and they were what's called Motzi Dibah, and they spoke Lashon Hara about Eretz Yisrael, and they were looking to discourage everyone from going in. And there were repercussions from that event, because that really was the beginning of what would ultimately become the Golus of Bnei Yisrael. The Gemara tells us in the end of Maseches Tanis that was actually took place on Tisha B'Av, the night that they came back. And then when everyone was crying, and it's very difficult words of the Gemara, Hashem says that you cried for nothing, so then you'll have something to cry for. Atem b'chisem b'chia shel chinam, so you'll receive b'chia l'doros. And what that means, perhaps even on a simple level, is that if the Jewish people are already much compromised in their consciousness in terms of their relationship to Eretz Canaan, so then it seems as if their relationship with it is not fully set, which means unless things improve, so Golus is in the wings. It's a real possibility, and if it happens, it will happen on this day of Tisha B'Av. And the idea that the ultimate, or more correctly, Golus ultimately was spawned on that evening is mefurish in the pasuk in Tehillim, which describes the Meraglim coming back, and then the pasuk says the Meraglim came and they spread bad rumors about Eretz Yisrael, and Hashem said that the words of the pasuk are lahapil zaram vagoyim ulezarosam ba'aratzos, that their descendants would then fall into the hands of non-Jews, and they would be dispersed throughout the lands. That's Golus. And that the Pasuk says in Tehillim, and Tehillim is before the first Golus, but it roots it back, or it traces it back, to that first Tisha B'Av. And it's interesting to note that the roots of Tisha B'Av in the Meraglim, or Meraglim as the root event behind it, finds expression in Megillas Eicha itself, which is, of course, is the Megillah of Tisha B'Av. And it does so in an interesting way. Out of the five prakim of Eicha, the first four follow the order of the Aleph Beis. As we know, Eicha begins with Aleph and it goes all the way from Aleph to Taf. And that's why three of them have 22 psukim, one has 66 because there's three for each letter. But they follow the order of the Aleph Beis. But that order is not preserved entirely. For in three of those four Aleph Beis Prakim, there is an anomaly. Two letters that are actually out of order. It's not the sort of thing that we tend to notice on Tisha B'Av because our minds are otherwise occupied, but it goes through Aleph Beis all the way until it gets to the letter Ayin. Because, of course, in the Aleph Beis, Ayin is first and followed by Pei. But in those Prakim of Eicha, actually the Pasuk of Pei comes before Ayin. Vadar Omer Darsheni, I mean, if everything's in Seder, whatever that represents, it clearly doesn't bode well, but whatever it means, if it is Kaseder, so then why is there a deviation from the Seder within the Aleph Beis? And the Gemara talks about this in Maseches Sanhedrin and Daf Kuf Dalet and comments, noting that there's an illusion here, because Pei and Ayin are letters, but they're also words. Pei is the mouth, and Ayin is the eye. And the Gemara says that the reason why in Eicha it puts the letter Pei before the Ayin is because that's what the Meraglim did. They put the Pei before the Ayin. That is to say, they put their mouth before the eyes. They spoke about things that they hadn't seen. The Pei worked without the Ayin. And therefore, that's preserved in the Seder of Eicha, that the Pei comes before Ayin. And this actually leads us back to our parsha to investigate. What do we mean when we say that the Meraglim omru b'fihem mashela ro'u be'enehem? They said with their mouths, well, they didn't see with their eyes. What did they say? Apparently they said things that weren't true. Now, we're used to the fact that they said things that were true, but they said them in a perhaps an inhibiting way or a startling way or a negative way. But is there anything that they said that they saw that they didn't actually see? And if so, what is it? Interestingly, in the Pasuk itself, it seems, in our Parsha, it seems to identify them as having things that were not true. But the Pasuk refers to them as motzi'e divas ha'aretz, vayotzi'u diva. That's in Pasuk Lamed Beis, vayotzi'u divas ha'aretz. What is the meaning of the expression lehotzi diva? The Ramban discusses this, and Ramban actually contrasts it, compares and contrasts, with a very similar expression of diva that we find earlier on in the Torah, namely with Yosef and the brothers. In the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev, there it says, "Vayave Yosef es dibasam ra'a el avihim." And now, the question is, what does this mean? Specifically, as interesting to note, "diba" appears in both phrases, but the verb in each case goes in different directions. In the case of Yosef, it says, "Vayave Yosef es dibasam." He brought diba. In the case of the Meraglim, it says, "Vayotziba." They produced diba. What's the difference between Lehavi Diba and Lehotzi Diba? Well, Ramban explains the difference is one is true and one is not true. That means that the Diba, both of them are negative. But if the Diba is true, it's there, you're just bringing it. You're just ferrying it to whoever, for better or for worse, possibly for worse. And therefore, as far as Ramban is concerned, whatever Yosef saw with the brothers, and that's really a discussion for Parshas Vayeshev, what did he see? Perhaps he didn't have told Yaakov, but whatever he told him were things that he saw. That's called Vayave Yosef. He brought the Diba, as opposed to the Meraglim, where the things that they said were actually produced by themselves. They didn't bring Diba, because the Diba that they mentioned were not things that they'd seen, but they produced it. That's called Lehotzi Diba. The question is it possible to find out what it is that they spoke about that they hadn't really seen? Well, some Mefarshim say as follows. It's interesting to note that when the Meraglim begin, and that's in Perek Pasuk Kaf Zayin and Kaftet, so they begin to, this is when they first come back, and they start out okay. They say it's Eretz Zavat Chalavu Dvash, so they got everyone's attention, and it all sounds good. But then they say other things, and in Pasuk Lamed, Kolev silences them. By Yahas Kaleb, it's onomatopoeia. He hushes them. He silences them. By Yahas Kaleb Esa'al Moshe. That means that Kaleb has already heard something that sets off an alarm for him in what the Meraglim have said. Now they will go on to say dreadful things. So far, everything they seem to be saying is in order. What has Kaleb heard that makes him quiet them, feel that he needs to silence them? And remember also, it's Kaleb specifically. We don't hear from Yehoshua at this stage until actually much later on. So the answer, according to some, is in Pasuk Kafchet. Perhaps in two ways. They begin by saying, Efes ki az ha'am. And some Rishonim actually say, Ramban, if I'm not mistaken, that a very troubling word already is the word Efes. Because Efes, perhaps the way we would translate it, is accept. And accept is no longer information. That's already judgment. As if to say, yes, it's true, but accept. And no one was asked him to say but or accept, because that's already judging. Is it good for the Jews? Is it not good for the Jews? Should we go in? Should we not go in? We'd like to go in, except that's already beyond that, or in the terminology of the Rebbe, as we mentioned before, that's already Meraglim. That's not Tarim. Tarim, you can say Az Ha'am. You can report what you saw. Efes already injects an element of, and therefore we don't think it's such a good idea to go in. And Kaleb, that raised a flag for Kaleb. However, Rav Avram Korman says something else. Towards the end of Pasuk Kavches, they begin, Efes ki as ha'am, the people are very bold, Hayoshev ba'aretz, they're in Betzuras Gedolos Ma'od, and the cities are fortified, so far, all true. And then, V'gam yilidei ha'anak ra'inu sham, and also we saw the sons of Anak, the sons of Ha'anak, sons of that giant. Okay, what's the background? Who are these Yilidei Ha'anak, and where are they? And who saw them? Well, this brings us back to Pasuk Kaf Beis. As they first enter the land, it says, Vayalu Vanegev, Vayavo Ad Chevron. They all went up Vanegev through the south, Vayavo Ad Chevron. And we cannot help but notice that the Pasuk has shifted from the plural, Vayalu, to the singular, to Vayavo. It sounds like only one of them went to Chevron. And Rashi tells us, again, from Sota Daf Lamed Daled, Kolev Levado Halach Sham. I mean, the Pasuk doesn't say which one. We have a Masorah about that. Kolev himself went there, v'nishtateach al kivrei avos, and he davened by kivrei avos, shelo yehi nises lechaveirov lios ba'atzosan, that he shouldn't be drawn in with the others. And that's actually why Kalev ended up receiving Chevron as part of his nachla in Eretz Kana'an. Now, we should note that the Pasuk seems to give us another piece of information about Chevron. Pasuk Kaf Beis, Vayalu Vanegev, Vayavor Chevron. What's in Chevron? Well, we know what's in Chevron, but perhaps something that we did not know that's in Chevron, or people we didn't know were there, Visham, Achiman, Sheshai, Vitalmai, Yilidei Ha'anak. There you had these three giants, the sons of Ha'anak, which pretty much gives it away, right? They're all these giants. And that's where they were, in Chevron. So it turns out something very interesting. Actually, only one of the Meraglim really saw Yilidei Ha'anak, and that's Kalev, who went to Hebron, because that's where they are. And the Pasuk emphasizes, Visham, there they are, Yilidei Achiman, Sheshev, Tamai, Yilidei Ha'anak. Okay, now, if the Meraglim, if the others are talking about Yilidei Ha'anak, which maybe they're entitled to, but they don't really know much about them, everything they know about Yilidei Ha'anak is from Kalev. But they're not, they don't say that Kalev saw Yilidei Ha'anak. They said that they saw Yilidei Ha'anak. The Shamra'inu as Yilidei Ha'anak. That already means trouble as far as Kalev is concerned, because he knows that everything they know about them, they know from him. Why are they talking as if they saw them themselves? That already seems to indicate that they're looking to instill fear within the people. We saw Yilidei Ha'anak and they didn't see them. That's something that they didn't see. And therefore Kalev hushes them, because he sees that no good is going to come of this. It's heading in a bad direction. And what's of further interest is that it's possible, I mean, here we are noting, of all the Meraglim, only Kalev went to Chevron. Of all the Meraglim, only Kalev saw this Yilidei HaAnak. What does everybody else know? Do they know anything? If anything, it's what they know from Kalev. So it's second-hand information. But it is possible that actually they had no information about Yilidei HaAnak, even from Kalev. How so? There's a fascinating comment of the Alshech HaKadosh. On that pasuk Kaf Beis, which says Vayalu Vanegev, Vayavo Al Chevro. Now we note number one that the pasuk has shifted from the plural to the singular, which we spoke about. But we should note something else: the pasuk is using pronouns. They went up through the Negev. He went to Chevron. The problem is that it's okay or understandable to use a pronoun with regards to Vaya'alu, because we know who we're talking about, because we referred to them already. They are the ones that were sent by Moshe, so there's no lack of information here. Vayavo is problematic, not only because it shifts from the plural to the singular, but also because it doesn't say who, and therefore there's information missing. It's what's known as sosum. It's a little bit covered over. It's not as explicit. And the Alshech says a stunning idea, and that is, it could be the reason why the Torah did not specify about that it was Kalev that went, is because that reflects the fact that Kalev himself did not tell anyone that he was going to Hebron. He kind of disappeared for a little bit, it happens, he didn't tell anyone that he was going to Hebron. And should we ask, well, why not? The answer is obvious. I mean, what's he doing in Hebron? He went to Hebron to daven that Hashem should save him from being following on with all the other Meraglim. Yet we know from Chazal, as quoted in Rashi, that Kalev actually allowed the Meraglim to believe that he was with them. That's why he had, in a sense, credit with them. He had the possibility of silencing them because they thought that he was with them. Yehoshua was in opposition from the outset. But Kalev, as the Pasuk describes him, as Ruach Acheres. Ruach Acheres, there was a certain duplicity within Kalev. In order that they should be able to listen to him, hopefully, when the time comes, he led them to understand that he was with them. And therefore, Kalev did not tell them that he's going to Hebron, because if he's giving them the understanding that it's in the cahoots with them, so then he can't tell them that he's gone to Hebron. And what's in Hebron? Kivri Avos. What's he davening for? Everything okay, Kalev? Is there a problem here? Of course, no problem. So he didn't tell them that he went to Hebron. And that lack of information on Kalev's part is reflected by the lack of information on the Torah's part. That's really the chiddush of the Alshech. In other words, you see how the Signon HaKatuv, you see how the way the Torah expresses itself is reflecting the nature of how things were done. His trip was sosum, so the pasuk is sosum. If that's true, then actually Kalev never told them they went to Hebron. If he saw these Yilidei HaAnak, but no one else knows that he saw them. They may know that they're there, which means that when they said that they saw, no one even told them about. So that is to say, not Kalev in terms of having seen them. They know that Yilidei HaAnak are there. Okay, that's known. But the irony of the of this Alshech is that, in a sense, they said that they saw Yilidei HaAnak, and it wasn't true. They didn't know that one of them actually did see Yilidei HaAnak, and he couldn't tell them about it, given the nature of things as it already was. So they're talking, and they're actually, what they're saying for one of their number is true, but they couldn't know it. So putting all this together, we already have what's called Hotsa'as Diba, in terms of making like they've seen Yilidei HaAnak. They may have heard that they have a reputation, I guess, those three or four, but that's already the pair working without the iron, talking about things they'd seen, but they hadn't seen. However, there is another level here. For we may ask, and we should note, interestingly, coming back to the pair and ayin, which is really fascinating, these two letters, and the order is reversed. As we noted, there's four prakim in Eicha that follow the Aleph Beis. But the reversal of Peh and Ayin only happens in three of those Prokim, namely 2, 3, and 4. But in Perek Aleph, actually, if you're on the lookout for the reversal of Peh and Ayin, you won't find it in Peh and Aleph. It's Ayin Peh and Ayin, it's Ayin Peh. So if this concept is here, why is it withheld from us for the first parak? I mean, that would be presumably the time to talk about it first. You want to talk about it again as well, that's one thing, but why is it not reflected Perek Aleph? And secondly, we may ask, if indeed it's true that they said things that they didn't see, so why is that called reversing Peh and Ayin? It sounds like the Peh's working without the Ayin at all. So I don't know what to suggest, but maybe there should be no pasuk of Ayin in those prakim, because it's not as if they saw it later. They didn't see it at all. So the problem is not that the Peh is before the Ayin, the Peh is without the Ayin. So maybe there should be 21 psukim in the prakim, which clearly is not the case. And that's why certain Mefarshim explain that the concept that we need to consider here is that of seeing. What does it mean, le'ayin? Or what does it mean, lirot? Because as we know, there are different levels of seeing. There is visual sight, which takes place with the eye, but there's deeper seeing, there's understanding, there's correct interpretation. A person can often see things, but they don't really see what's going on. The fuller meaning of seeing takes place within the heart. And indeed, the Gemara says in Maseches Avodah Zarah and Daf Chet that the eyes have a special connection with the heart, because seeing begins with the eyes, ends with the heart. And this brings us, in a sense, to the Meraglim. The Zohar Kodesh tells us, on a certain level, the Meraglim had a vested interest against going into Eretz Canaan, because they thought that when there would be a reshuffle. That means whoever's the Nasi now is not the Nasi to Eretz Canaan. And it's good to be the Nasi. Which means that although that's stated very simply, and is probably more complex than that nonetheless, somehow within the motivation of the Meraglim is to stay in the Siyam. And that, or something like that, can already affect the way a person sees things. Even if they report based on facts, but to fully understand, it's possible that it might not happen. And a case, perhaps, that will illustrate this is something that they say later on, Eretz Ocheles Yoshveahi. That's in Pasuk Lamed Beis. Eretz Ocheles Yoshveahi. The land kills. The land consumes its inhabitants. People that live there tend to die there at an alarming rate. Then why do they say that? What did they see that made them think that? Well, Rashi tells us, again from the Gemara, Eretz Ocheles Yoshveha. The reason is because Bechol Mokom She'avarnu Mitzanum Kovrei Mesim. Wherever we went, we saw they were burying the dead. So, very alarming. I mean, what a place to be. I mean, everywhere we went, there was Leviathans. It's a dangerous place. That's what they saw. Just reporting. Now, the background to this, as we know, is, Rashi continues, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Asa L'tova. Hashem arranged this. He killed a dignitary in each place. In order that everyone should be preoccupied with the mourning and with the Leviath, and no one should pay any attention to these Meraglim. They should be able to go about whatever they need to do, unmolested, uncontested. So you have an interesting situation where something was meant for the good, but interpreted for the bad. And here the Shaila is, well, can you blame the Meraglim? In other words, Leviath looks a lot like Leviath. So should they have known that it was really meant for the good? Can they be faulted? Well, apparently, they can. For a couple of reasons. Firstly, as true as it sounds, that there's an alarmingly high death rate, seemingly, in this place, but if one considers it for long enough, it can't be. Because if the death rate exceeds the birth rate, then there should be no national population. I mean, how can a nation live there if they die more than they live? So there is a massive population, so it's clearly it's not the nature of the land, otherwise there couldn't be an indigenous population there, and they, which of course they know there was. Secondly, and without putting too fine a point on it, the very fact that wherever they went, the entire town was at the Levaya should clearly indicate that this is not a normal state of affairs in the country. Because, to put it delicately, if it is, you wouldn't have the whole town turning up to every Levaya. And if everybody dies like this the whole time, so then it would be a much more business-like affair. The fact that there was mass hysteria and mass mobbed Levayas, that itself should tell them that this was an unusual occurrence. It doesn't represent the nature of the land. It doesn't represent the norm. It represents the departure from the norm. These are, in a sense, finer points, although they're not out of reach unless a person doesn't wish to reach for them, in which case they'll just stay with the very linear Levayas equals Eretz Ocheles Yoshbeahi. And therefore, it's a bit more nuanced, shall we say. When we say that they said things that they didn't see, they said things, they put the mouth before the eye, what it means is that they spoke, they enunciated their evaluations before having thought things through properly. And with this in mind, perhaps we can understand why it is that the first perek of Eicha actually retains the order of ayin before pei, of seeing before speaking. Because the first perek, which represents the first type of seeing, the most external type of seeing, the order was indeed preserved. They saw and then they spoke. The breakdown occurred on the level represented by every subsequent perek, which are all of the deeper levels, the more inner levels of seeing. Anything beyond the external shell represented by Perek Aleph, the order is already reversed. Visually, they may have seen before they spoke, but in terms of correct judgment and evaluation, they spoke before seeing properly. That's why the departure happens only after from Perek Beis and onwards. So these are important insights into the Meraglim, a little bit of discussion as to what it was that went wrong, and the important lesson for us, of course, is that this remains to be true, that people see, very often decide what it is that they have seen, and it shapes really the way that they evaluate what on paper is raw information and evidence. But apparently it's very difficult to find pure evidence. Very often there's an admixture of interpretation, and the result is the facts as they are enunciated. And it's interesting to note in this vein that the Parsha of Shelach concludes with the Parsha of Tzitzis, and although that seems to be a far cry from the Meraglim, but there are actually linguistic similarities between them, because the Meraglim are told in the beginning Uri'isem es ha'aretz, and we're told at the end Uri'isem oso. The Meraglim are told V'yosuru es ha'aretz, and we're told V'lo sasuru acharei levavchem v'acharei neichem, which means The mitzvah of tzitzis contains within it a message as to how not to look at things. And the order is very interesting, because it says acharei levavchem v'acharei einechem, after your heart and after your eyes. And the Sifrei actually raises the question, well, surely the heart is affected by what the eye sees. Should it not have said acharei einechem, which then leads to, based on what you've seen, acharei levavchem? To which the Sifrei responds, no. Very often that's not the case, but rather acharei levavchem is how it starts, and that leads to acharei einechem, because the heart decides what it is that the eyes will see. So the way to see things correctly really does begin acharei levavchem, and all of this to a certain degree in the wake of and in response to what happened with the Meraglim. So it begins with those 12 men, but it's a lesson for all of Am Yisrael in so many, many situations. So I'd like to just move now for the final segment to talk about the punishment of the Meraglim. And as we will see, I submit that what we're about to see is not so well known, but it deals with some very basic questions in Pshuto Shel Mikra. So let's take a look at Perek Yud Dalet, Pasuk Yud Aleph. And that's where Hashem is talking about the Meraglim, and Pasuk Yud Aleph, Perik Yud Dalet states, Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Ad Ana Yinatsuni Ha'amazeh, for how long will this people provoke me, anger me, Vad Ana Le'aminu Bi, for how long will they not believe in me, B'chola Osas Asher Asisi B'kirbo, after all the signs that I've placed in their midst. So if we read carefully, we will see that the people have been divided or described in two ways. The first phrase is Ad Ana Yina'atsuni Ha'amazeh, so when will they anger me? Vad Ana Le'aminu Bi, for how long will they not believe me, in me? And on the face of it, it really sounds like two ways of saying the same thing. In other words, how are the people angering Hashem? Because they're not believing in Him. Rather, they believe the Meraglim. So, Yina'atsuni and Lo Yaminu Bi, it seems to be two ways of expressing the same thing. Well, apparently, it isn't. And the reason why is because if we move to Perek Kaf, to Pasuk Kaf Aleph, which is already now the punishment of that generation, Pasukaf Aleph Ulam Chai Ani, Vimalek Vel Hashem Es Kol Haaretz. This is an expression of Shavua already. Ki Kol Ha'anashim Haro'im Es Kodiva So So Sai. All of those who have seen my glory. And what will happen, Pasukaf Gimel, Im Yeru Es Haaretz. Im, of course, is the second part of the Shavua. If they will see, meaning, like we say, Ashenish Bati Ba'api, Im Yiva'una Manuchasi. It's the conclusion of the Shavua. The Shavua says that they will not see the land Asher Nishbati Lavosam, V'chol Mena'atzai Lo Yiruha, and all those that anger me will not see it. So once again, we have what seems to be a division, or two categories, because the first is about they will not see, whoever they are, presumably those that are at fault, those that sinned, and then the Pasuk concludes, V'chol Mena'atzai Lo Yiruha, and those that angered me will not see it, but that seems to be a restatement of the Shavua. So what are we to make of these two elements here? Now, this gezeira, as we know, of dying out in the Midbar, it found its mark every year on Tisha B'Av, actually. But the final year was an exception, because in the final year, as the Gemara talks about it, it's well known, they thought that they were going to die that year number 40, but they didn't. And they spent the five very uncomfortable nights thinking that maybe they made a mistake, until they realized that there was no mistake, and they'd actually been given a reprieve, that final batch, that final group. And that's the one of the origins of Tu B'Av. There are a number of contributing factors and causes to Tu B'Av. But the original Tu B'Av was the day that that group of people realized that it wasn't Tisha B'Av anymore, and they were okay, the moon is full, and they're still alive. There's just one problem, or two problems actually. Firstly, seemingly, this group of people thought that, it seems that there was a group of people that were part of the gezeira, or part of this decree, and in the end it was somehow rescinded, seemingly. And the reason why we say that is because that group of people thought that they were them. And presumably they were correct. I mean, their calculations were correct. And moreover, the alternative is simply that they didn't realize that they weren't meant to die, so then nothing really happened, except they just realized that they weren't meant to die. But there was no reprieve. So then why is Tu B'Av such a special day? It's very nice that they didn't die, but if they thought that they would die just based on a mistake, that was an unfortunate error, caused them a lot of discomfort, but in reality, nothing actually happened. People thought that they were part of the gezeira, and they weren't. But we have Tu B'Av, and it really sounds like they really were part of the gezeira. Okay. But this is problematic in two ways. The notion that there were those that were part of that generation that were meant or originally part of the decree, and in the end somehow were granted clemency, is difficult because later on, In the end of Bamidbar, Parshas Pinchas, when it talks about that generation, the Pasuk states explicitly in Perek Kavav, Pasuk Samach Hei, all of them died out. Velo nosar mehem ish, and not one person remained of them. Ki im Kaleb ben Yefune v'Yoshua ben Nun, with two exceptions, no one else remained. Well, if no one else, if the pasuk is telling us that no one else remained, so then how can the Gemara tell us that there was an entire group of thousands of people that remained? That's a very difficult situation. And that is, that question is actually raised by Tosfos in Maseches Bava Basra and Daf Kuf Kaf Aleph. Secondly, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Rosh Hashanah and Daf Yud Zayin that sometimes the tzibur has greater repealing power and tshuva power than the individual. And the Gemara, the way the Gemara phrases it is that there can be a gezar din, the time of a decree when it's already been finalized, and at that point it's too late for a yochid. So says the Gemara, for an individual. But for a rabbin, for a tzibur, they can repeal even a gezar, even after there's been a gezar din. However, there is one caveat. There's one proviso. And that is, as the Gemara further there in Rosh Hashanah and Daf Yud Ches, that's only if the Gezar Din is not accompanied by a Shavua, by an oath on the Kodesh Baruch Hu's part. But if it's accompanied by a Shavua, so then nothing will help. Not for a Yochid, not for a Rabbi. Now, that being the case, so let's come back to our situation. Because here we are saying that there were certain people that escaped the Gezar Din. They wanted a reprieve from a Gezar Din. But this Gezar Din has been accompanied by a Shavua, as we read from the Psukim, Pasuk Kaf Aleph, Chayoni, Nu'um Hashem, V'ulam Chayoni. That's a Shavua. Im Yu'u, Sa'aretz, Hashem Nishbati, they won't see it. Hashem Nishbati Ba'api, Im Yu'unam, Anu Chasi. That's a Shavua. But the Gemara says if this is a Shavua, there's no repeal, even for a Tzibur. So how can there have been a repeal? These are the rather weighty questions that are asked about this. And a stunning approach to this matter is found in the writings of Reb Velvel Soloveitchik, the son of Reb Chaim, in his writings on the Torah. And he begins by referring us to a statement of the Medrash Rabbah, Bamidbar Rabbah. And by way of background, we should state, and we'll see it in the Psukim, that there were actually two levels of wrongdoing on the part of the Jewish people. The Meraglim got things going. But then the question is, what about the people? Were they homogenous? Was their reaction all the same? There were two levels of reaction within the Jewish people. There were those that believed the Meraglim, which apparently was everyone. But there were those that also then aided and promoted what the Meraglim were saying. It spread, and it received adherence and proponents, and exponents. And the Medrash, after that background, says as follows. There was a distinction in terms of those that were part of the Gezeirah to die out in the Midbar, between those that were above the age of 20, and those that were between Bar Mitzvah, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Bar Mitzvah as far as this is concerned, Bar Mitzvah and 20. The way the Medrash phrases it is, from the age of 20, everyone was in the Gezeirah. But from the age of 13, for those 7 years, between 13 and 20, im hayu imahem be'etza, if he was with them, with the Meraglim, this person, with the Meraglim in their council, so then he wouldn't go in. Lo hayu imahem be'etza, if he wasn't there with them in their council, he would go in. And what that means is, in terms of being with them in their council, as the Brisker Rav explains it, is were they actively promoting and spreading what the Meraglim were saying? That's called imahem ba'etza. They got involved actively. They became activists. As opposed to lo ha'imahem, he believed it, but he didn't get involved actively. And with this in mind, we can come back to our questions. You see, with regards to the first group, those that were actively involved, so that means already for anyone who was over the age of Bar Mitzvah was already part of the Gezeirah. And it's very interesting to note that although our Pasuk talks explicitly about those who were over the age of 20, as we will see. But there's another pasuk in Chumash Devarim, Perek Aleph, pasuk Lamates. And there it says, Uvnechem, this is going over the parsha of the Meraglim, Uvnechem and your children, Asher lo yotu hayom tovara, who do not know the difference between good and evil, Hema yavo'u shama, they will come, Belahem etnen avahem yurashua. So it's very interesting that in Parsha Shelach, there seems to be a reference to those who are over 20. They're the ones that won't go in. But in Chumash Devarim, it talks about those that would go in are those that don't yet know the difference between Tov and Ra. Das, and every type of a significant Das, is from the time of Bar Mitzvah, not from the time of 20. And that's really telling us that the only group that as an entire group were assured of going in were those that were younger than Bar Mitzvah. Asher lo yodu hayom bein tov l'ra. Because if they're over Bar Mitzvah, there's a chance they wouldn't go in because if they were actively involved. And this brings us now back to the division of yina'atsuni, those that anger me, and lo ya'aminu bi. That's how it all began. Hashem says, and we noted that that seems to be two separate things. Is it not the same thing? No, it's not the same thing. Yina'atsuni refers to those that actively angered. That is to say, those, in the words of the Gemara, the Medrash, those that were imahim be'etza, actively involved. Lo yaminu bi was the general populace who weren't involved, but they didn't believe. Those are two things. And now, if we come to the Shavua, so back again, the Shavua begins in Pasuk Kaf Aleph. I mean, the Reb Velvel here is very in the Psukim, as we've seen. That's where it all comes from. The Shavua begins in Pasuk Kaf Aleph, Ve'ulam Chai Oni, and it says, Pasuk Kaf Gimel, Im Yir'u, Es ha'aretz asher nishbati la'avosam, which is the Shavua, they will not see that land. And then an additional phrase, v'chol mena'atzai lo yu'uha, and all of those that anger me will see it. That's a broader category because it's even those that are younger than 20, from 13 to 20. But what's important to realize is that final phrase is not part of the Shavua. It's phrased as a separate statement. The first phrase is im yiru, if they will see, im yivauna manuchasi. That im is the end of the Shavua. But it doesn't go on to say v'im mena'atzai yiruha. V'chol mena'atzai lo yiruha, that final phrase is no longer part of the Shavua. It's a gezar din, but it's a gezar din without a Shavua. And this now leads us back to Tu B'Av. Because we had a problem in that it seemingly there were those that were scheduled to be part of the Gezerah, but they received a reprieve. But how could it be? It's a Gezar Din, and the Gezar Din was accompanied by a Shavua. Apparently, the ones that received the reprieve were not the ones that were over 20 that year, but between 13 and 20 who were part of the Gezerah without a Shavua, the Chol Mena'atzai Lo Yu'uha, they are the ones. They are the Tu B'Av group. And moreover, with this in mind, if we come back to the pasuk in Pinchas, which tells us that of that whole generation, lo nosar mehem ish, no one remained, with two exceptions, kim kaleb ben yefune v'yoshua ben nun. And that was a problem, because apparently there's this whole group that remained. Well, yes, but the pasuk in Pinchas is talking about counting of Bnei Yisrael. It's within the context of the final count of Bnei Yisrael. Bnei Yisrael are counted from the age of 20 and upwards. From 20 and upwards, no one remained with the exception of Kalev and Yehoshua. But the group of Tu B'Av, which we're talking about here, are not within that category, rather younger than 20. They are the Mena'atzai. And they were the ones that were left over. So it's a real sweeping parshanut. But you see how the Briska Rav, and it's the Soloveitchik way of looking at everything, and it's really two dinim in the end. I mean, there's the Lo Yaminu Bi and Lo Yinatsuni with the Shvua, without the Shvua, and classic insights and classic analysis of the Briska Rav. We'll leave it over there for this evening.